IVM. We are well and truly into the second wave of COVID-19 in India. It has had a devastating impact. The numbers tell the story, and perhaps even not, because by most estimates, the actual numbers are far more frightening. There are so many issues around the second wave that I have a very special guest on the note with me, Dr. Vincent Rajkumar, who's a professor of medicine at Mayo Clinic, somebody who has been looking at India particularly. He, in fact, is one of many doctors who have tried to extend their help in any way possible, and also an authority on what's really happening in India. Dr. Vincent Rajkumar, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Dr. Rajkumar, let me first begin by asking you, I've seen a lot of tweets that you've put out, interviews that you've given to US organizations of how you were trying to reach out and help as many people in India. How did that happen?
Well, we thought, like most people around the world and in India, that India somehow managed to escape devastation from the COVID virus. And that was true even towards the end of February. And so it came as a big shock and a heartbreak to all of us to see the crisis explode the way it did, to see the pictures played out on social media and on television of hospitals being completely swamped and all the scenes that followed. We have many, many friends and family in India, and we keep in touch with a number of people in the medical field. And so we have been dealing and getting requests for help. It's strange to be 10,000 miles away and trying to get a bed for people in India because someone thinks that we may know someone who might have a hospital bed or oxygen. And so it's just something that has drawn us into it. And now we're just trying to do the best we can, whether it's through fundraising, whether it's through providing direct patient care, or whether it be educating physicians or just providing guidelines. Many of this is being done by a group called India COVID SOS, which I'm part of.
So we understand that the situation is really bad. We're in the middle of a humanitarian medical crisis. The cities seem to be slightly better now, even though the rural hinterlands of India seem to be in a terrible mess. By all measure, vaccination is the most important thing. But even before I get into that, how do you think we got here? Why did it become so bad for India?
Yeah, and I've thought about it a lot because I got it wrong. Towards the end of February, I thought that somehow when you had 40, 50% seroprevalence in New Delhi, in Mumbai, and in Pune, and in Chennai, that it seemed like something somehow miraculously India had escaped the very serious devastation that COVID causes. But then I think what has happened is that towards fall and by November, people in India started behaving as if the pandemic was over, which led to a lot of crowds, a lot of people without masks. Mm. And what it does is it causes infections to start and infections to also occur with very high viral dose. And as more and more infections happened, I think the second factor was that there was a mutation which caused a variant that is even more transmissible. In the first wave, if one person in the family got infected, it affected maybe one other person or 10% of the family members. Now, almost the whole family, the 100% of the family is affected. And then right. It becomes an exponential spread. So the second factor is a variant that looks like it's much more transmissible. And the third one, I think, is that I really do believe from clinical features, the young people getting affected, multiple young people in the same family seriously ill dying, that the variant is not only more transmissible, but also more virulent. It is able to take a healthy person and put them into a position of needing a hospital within a few days, very severe lung damage, and that's leading to complete collapse of the healthcare system because everyone wants oxygen at the same time. And, this is what exponential curves do. is like, you know, 2 becomes 4, 4 becomes 8, and then pretty soon you're just dealing with extreme. That's why you saw the caseload go up so skyrocketing. And the only ways out of it are, you know, the usual epidemiologic principles. You have to lock down to prevent people from coming into contact with other people, which breaks the chain of transmission. And the lockdowns are effective. And I don't know, like you said, about the rural areas, but in the cities, certainly the cases seem to be coming down. You can see that in the numbers that are reported, as well as in what hospitals are experiencing in terms of number of new patients in the emergency rooms. So the cases are coming down in the cities. We have no idea what's happening in the rural areas. But the lockdowns are the first way out of it. And the vaccination is the truly sustainable way out of it long term.
You know, one of the things that you've mentioned on social media is drug-resistant bacteria. That seems to be one of the things that is prevalent in India. How has that happened, and what kind of evidence do we have to suggest that? Is that why the treatment for COVID-19 in India has constantly changed? Because initially, in the first stages of the second wave, we heard of certain medicines doing the rounds, and then there was plasma therapy. Now it seems that steroids seem to be far more effective. So is that because this is a drug-resistant kind of bacteria, or is it because we simply don't know? The medical fraternity doesn't know enough.
So again, if we step back, normally COVID has an infection fatality rate of 0.5%. That's 1 in 200 people die for out of people who get infected. If you have symptoms of COVID, then the mortality rate is about 2%. But even in New York and early on in the pandemic in Lombardy last year, you saw mortality rates, case fatality rates of 10 to 20%. That's because when the healthcare system is overwhelmed, you are not able to save the people who could have been saved if the healthcare system was functioning at its usual speed. So I think a lot of deaths in India are because all of it happened at the same time and the healthcare system was overwhelmed. Doctors didn't have time to make sure that all the patients were taken care of properly. And then you ran out of resources. Even in a resource-rich country like the US, we had shortage of oxygen and ventilators, at least ventilators. Yes. But in India, there was an enormous shortage of oxygen, enormous shortage of ventilators, hospital beds. And that means people who could be saved couldn't be saved. The third problem is there is a lot of indiscriminate use of antibiotics in India. And I know I practiced in India. I trained in India. Yes. And I keep in touch with India and Indian physicians. There's a lot of, even the guidelines say give doxycycline or azithromycin. And those are broad spectrum antibiotics which will breed drug resistant bacteria. So there's a lot of antibiotic use that causes secondary infections with bacteria that are even more drug resistant. And then fourthly, you have the use of steroids, which are a double-edged sword. These are drugs that actually prevent your body from killing COVID. And if you use it early, you're just going to cause more problems. It looked like the fever has gone away and the patient's feeling better. But behind the scenes, the drug is preventing your immune system from clearing the virus. And sooner or later, people are going to get very, very severely sick. So the steroids have a role only if the patient's already having a low oxygen. And that's not what we see in India. People were using steroids and are still using steroids early on. And when they do use it at a much higher dose than is recommended and for a much longer period than it's recommended. All of that together means you have secondary bacterial infection because these steroids do suppress the immune system. And secondary fungal infections like mucor and black fungus.
Yes.
So you are causing, COVID is one cause of death, but then the health system collapse, the shortage of beds, the shortage of oxygen, the shortage, the drug-resistant bacteria, the drug-resistant fungal infections, it just amplifies what would have been a 2% mortality into 20% or 30% mortality rate.
You talk about mucor or black fungus. Have you seen this kind of a reaction or the fact that it's being called an epidemic in India in other parts of the world? Has it been the rampant use of steroids? Is it because oxygen cylinders were old? Is it because the hospital systems by ways of which patients were being administered, oxygen was faulty? What do you think has led to this?
So the first question is, have we seen it in other places? No. And have we seen it in the first wave in India? No.
No.
So this is a new thing. Why is it happening? There are definitely, you know, to have Mucor, you need to have two things. Mucor is there everywhere in India, and Mucor is not that prevalent here. So that's one of the things. Mucor is there, the spores are there. But by itself, you or I would not get Mucor in India because Mucor requires the patient's immune system to be suppressed. So whether there is Mucor in the oxygen tanks or in the water or in the air is not something we can deal with quickly because we need the oxygen, we need to do it. So, but on the other hand, we can modify the second factor that is critical for Mucor. Mucor will not grow if the blood sugars are fully controlled. So if you can control the blood sugars, keep it less than 200, because the prevalence of diabetes is high and the patient load is high, people may not even know somebody is diabetic, but and not check it enough. So blood sugars, keeping it low, and steroids increase the blood sugars, and judicious use of steroids and checking the sugars when people are on steroids, and recognizing that steroids and other drugs we use, tocilizumab, they all suppress the immune system, and that allows Mucor to grow. So even though I cannot solve why you have more Mucor fungus, whether it's the oxygen or water or something, I can solve the second component that is needed for Mucor, which is the immunosuppression and the high blood sugars. If we deal with that, then the incidence of Mucor will go down and we'll have a leisurely time to figure out whether it was the oxygen or the cylinder or whatever else that caused it.
You have consistently and rightly so advocated vaccination for all. And so are all, you know, experts, medical experts suggesting that. But there's a lot of debate and conversation in India about which vaccine is better, given that there are now statements being made that a certain kind of vaccination done would make it easier for you to travel abroad. So then people are rushing towards that particular kind of vaccine. Is there any difference really between different vaccines? And why is it that the WHO is recognizing some and perhaps not recognizing others? What should listeners of the note really look out for when it comes to vaccination?
So, you know, the vaccines for COVID are a humongous success. I mean, it is just something unprecedented. We had a new pandemic start in January, and by December, you had vaccines that were approved for emergency use in the US and around the world.
Right.
They protect people from infection.
Mm.
When it comes to preventing just infection per se, we know that the mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer and the Moderna, have a 95% efficacy, and that drops to 70% or so with AstraZeneca, with Covaxin, with Covishield, Novavax, and others. So there is a difference in that. But when you talk about preventing severe disease in the fully vaccinated, then all vaccines seem to be highly effective, more than 95%, 100%, close to 100% efficacy in preventing deaths and hospitalization. So that's the lesson to take, is that all these vaccines seem to be very effective in preventing severe COVID. And right now is not the time to decide, I will get this vaccine or that. Just the best vaccine is the first one you can get. And I have told that consistently to my own parents who live in India, and I've just said, like, just get whatever vaccine. So in my own first degree relatives, some have had Covaxin, some have had Covishield. It's basically when they ask me, I tell the same, just whatever you can get first, just get it. Because all of them seem to be helpful. The fact that Covaxin results are not published in peer-reviewed literature, and we don't have good details like we do have with the other vaccines, that might be the reason why the WHO guidelines and the travel restrictions may seem to be different. But once they publish it, and if the results truly are the way they say they are, then it should not be a problem, and people will accept it elsewhere outside of India.
Okay, that's good to hear. And I hope the listeners of the note are listening into you, to what you're saying. That's some great advice coming in. Now there is this antibody cocktail that's coming to India. A lot of medical experts, doctors are giving it the thumbs up. Of course, famously used by the former American president, or that's the kind of tagline that it comes with. What is your opinion on this antibody cocktail? Given that, I mean, it's expensive, not most people can use it. It's obviously meant for the rich and the influential. What are your thoughts on it?
So I will tell you what I honestly tell people is that this does seem to work, but you have to take it early. And if you take it early, it'll prevent hospitalization and serious illness. So I think it is definitely an effective drug to consider. The high price tag is one problem. The fact that you need to diagnose COVID early and take it early before you are hypoxic is the second problem. Now, also that you have this problem of when there is a healthcare crunch and a resource shortage, then if, you know, people with resources take away space in the hospitals to get monoclonal antibodies, what it does for the healthcare system, for the others, that has to be taken into consideration. But I have advised people here as well as in India to, if they have the resources and if they are immunosuppressed, if they have some kind of cancer or some kind of immune system disorder, or if they are very elderly, to certainly take the monoclonal antibody cocktail. And you have to take it early, so upon the diagnosis. Like even yesterday, I was advising somebody in India, just, you know, as soon as they have cancer and they're immunosuppressed. So as soon as the diagnosis is made, see if you can get it. That's what I'm advising. But, you know, it's going to, like you said, help only a small percentage of society. And, you know, that's the unfortunate reality right now.
Dr. Rajkumar, official records say that close to 300,000 people have died in India because of COVID-19. And there are a large number of experts, media reports that suggest that the number could be several times higher. Now, as a medical professional, as a professor of medicine, as somebody who views India not just as an Indian, but somebody who's lived and born here and worked here, but also from an American perspective, since you currently live there, how does the world really view us? And the fact that perhaps fatalities could be suppressed, because it's not really going to help in the fight against COVID. How do you view this?
I don't view it in any negative sense. In the US, well accepted that our confirmed cases are 33 million or something. But the true cases is even the CDC acknowledges is three times that. So it's probably like, you know, 100 million or 110 million. So the fact is that no country can count all the cases. It's only the scale that varies. No country can count all the deaths. I mean, the WHO has estimated that what the whole global toll from COVID, which is at 3.3 or 3.4 million deaths, is an underestimate, and that many, many more people have died if you look at, you know, overall mortality. So in India, I think because of lack of testing in the rural areas, and when you have a very big crisis, and we are telling, even I have told patients, if you think you may have COVID, just stay at home and take precautions. Don't just try to get tested.
Right.
Because you might just put others at risk. That you are not going to be counting all the cases. Secondly, we have zero prevalence that was done prior to the second wave in Mumbai, in Delhi, in Pune, in Chennai, which showed that 40, 50% had been exposed to COVID by antibody tests. So we knew that, you know, a lot more people have been missed than what was diagnosed. And so I do think my educated guess, looking at various numbers, is that in the US, it's a threefold underestimate. In India, it's a tenfold underestimate. So whatever the number of cases we are reporting in India right now, you make it tenfold. But even a tenfold, I mean, the New York Times estimates that 700 million people may have had COVID in India at the worst case scenario. That still leaves another 700 million who have not had COVID and therefore are susceptible. And therefore, you could still get millions of deaths. So you can't take the risk. You just have to take the precautions because the population is so vast.
You talk about susceptibility, and obviously that points to a possible third wave. There are some who say that, you know, children could be impacted in the third wave, perhaps because of their vulnerability and the fact that they're not vaccinated. What do you see as the possibility of a third wave? Do you see it coming, as some have predicted, towards August or fall? And what is the road ahead for India, finally, as you see it?
So, you know, the third wave depends on all of the people in India and how they view this seriously and take precautions. You know, every country that has relaxed before people get vaccinated adequately will get another wave and has had another wave. We are hoping that after vaccination, this wave won't happen, but who knows? People just have to be very careful. And as the restrictions from the lockdowns, state-by-state lockdowns are lifted, people need to be educated that they still need to wear masks. They still need to avoid crowds. They still need to avoid indoor gatherings without masks, except with people they live with, and be safe till they themselves are vaccinated. and try to vaccinate as quickly as possible. If we do that, then the third wave is not inevitable, because you can suppress, the masks will help you also from reducing viral dose and keeping the infections milder. The true reality is that the more people who get COVID now, the less people there are to get reinfections later. So that might also dampen the third wave. So my hope is that if the leaders set good examples and the messaging is clear to the public and vaccination is undertaken with a very, very serious intensity, that requires just not only the Indian government's help, but also the West to help out with vaccines and vaccine raw materials, then the third wave may not be as inevitable as we think it is. And I don't see any reason why it should be more serious than children. I think we just try our best to avoid it and, you know, be single-minded in that view.
Okay. Dr. Rajkumar, for your insights and for your valuable time, thank you so much for joining me on The Note.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
If you like this podcast, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can listen to us on the IVM Podcast app or ivmpodcast.com. You can also follow us on our social media. We are @IVM Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And if you want to reach out to me, I'm Mahrukh Inayat on Twitter and Mahrukh Inayat on Instagram as well.